Hello and welcome to the AmBOSS podcast, Beyond the Textbook. Every 2 weeks, experts from AmBOSS, the medical education platform, interview medical students and healthcare professionals to showcase international perspectives on everything in medical school and beyond the textbook. Hello and welcome to the AmBOSS podcast, Beyond the Textbook. I'm your host, Dr. Tanner Schrank, along with Sophie Neal. And we'll be presenting an iconic figure in the field of global health today. She's a physician and associate professor, a chief medical officer, and a leading voice in healthcare. We're privileged today to welcome Dr. Joya Mukherjee, chief medical officer at Partners in Health and educator at Harvard Medical School. This is part one of a two-part interview with Dr. Mukherjee, and this is the beginning of our mini-series on leading women in healthcare. Dr. Mukherjee, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Could you start by telling us a little more about what led you to the field of global health and your passion for education and social justice?
Yeah. So I'm a person who grew up with a lot of privilege. I'm an American, born and raised in the U.S. My dad is of Indian descent and immigrated when he was an adult. My mom is Euro-American. But as a young child, we returned to India to visit my dad's family. And I think that's where the cracks in the armor of privilege started to let the light in of the stark realities of the world. And we were going to Calcutta in 1972, which was just the very tail end of the war between Pakistan and Bangladesh. And Calcutta was flooded with people escaping the dire economic consequences of the war and of their lives. And so just seeing thousands and thousands of people on the street, and I was eight, and seeing kids my own age having to beg, having to carry their siblings, people who were very disfigured from polio, from leprosy. And then returning to my privileged life, I think, was sort of the beginning of my search for how the world is so riven with inequity. And so then throughout my sort of childhood, I was very curious about different things I would learn about, from, you know, the trial of Nelson Mandela to the civil rights movement in the United States. And then went to college just as the AIDS epidemic had started, 1981, the first cases of Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia were written about. And it seemed within months, if not the first year, that this was going to be another disease that was stigmatized, like leprosy or polio, that was going to affect people who lived on the margins of society. And so with this curiosity about how inequality, you know, gets in the body and how privilege really gives you not only wealth, but a healthy life, that's how I got interested in health disparities, I would say, global health in a big scale, like the U.S. being on the globe, and started to really see it everywhere. I worked in a shelter for women who were victims of domestic violence. And there again, I saw that poor women were the ones who used our shelter. And it wasn't that wealthy women weren't getting abused, but they had credit cards and cars and wealthy families. And so I think my pursuit led me to medical school and then Africa in 1991. And, you know, again, this was just reinforced that not only were people living with terrible diseases, many of these diseases were treatable and no treatment was available. So I became committed to use my medical training to bring actual treatment to people and with people. So that really was sort of my trajectory. And, you know, seeing the dedication of the Kenyan nurses, particularly that I worked with, and the people in the community made me think, I just want to be helpful. I want to work with a team of people who's doing this. I don't want to be one person thinking about this. I want to join others. And so that's sort of how I got interested in it.
What a journey to get to where you are. And it's incredibly interesting, and especially what an impact it must have had on you at that age as well. So thank you for sharing that. And then could you talk a bit about some of the challenges that you see associated with the delivery of comprehensive healthcare and how these could be addressed?
Yeah. So when I first worked in Africa in 1991, I was working at a small mission hospital. people did get charged for their medical care. Often when they were feeling a little bit better, they would escape or abscond because they didn't have the money for the bills. So that was somewhat outrageous. I returned to Africa to do more public health a few years later, doing HIV prevention. And what I realized was there was not a system of care for people. So there were some private facilities that were doing their best, but often charging people. But the public facilities, the public health mindset was really just to do prevention and not treatment. And when I returned to the United States from Uganda, having seen hundreds of people die of HIV in the mid-90s, that was when we had highly active antiretroviral therapy discovered as something that would turn a death sentence into a manageable chronic condition. And it seemed crazy that those medicines would not immediately be deployed to the epicenter of the illness and where the most suffering was, which was in sub-Saharan Africa. So, of course, that's what I assumed people would do, but that was not the case. And rather, people say it's too complicated. There's no infrastructure. There's no way to absorb the medicines into a system. And so I was very frustrated, and I was going to actually leave academic medicine because the academics didn't seem to have any concern about how their science would end up getting into the people who need it the most. And so I started to look to maybe go to an NGO or something, and I stumbled upon a very tiny organization at the time called Partners in Health. Really was the only organization I had come across at the time in my searching that was talking about AIDS treatments. And they were treating a handful of patients in Haiti with a highly active antiretroviral therapy, and also the intersection between poverty and illness. And so those were things that I found extremely unique, albeit a very tiny group of people. And so I kind of signed up. And, you know, again, I found a mission hospital at first in Conj, Haiti, associated with the Episcopal Church, but with no fees. So at least people were getting treatment for free. Then as we expanded to Peru, the model there was really to work as much as possible with the public sector. And that started to make sense because then people have access to care as a basic right. As Partners in Health became more able to pass the message that people should be treated, they can be treated in Haiti for HIV and Peru for drug-resistant TB, we started winning arguments along with AIDS activists, governments, people living in the global south who were calling for this kind of equity. And in the first sort of set of big funding we had, one from the Gates Foundation for TB scale-up, and second, from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria for HIV scale-up in Haiti, in those two grants, we made a very specific plan, which was to work with the public sector and to use this money to make whatever treatment it was available to everyone, not just in small pockets, not as a charitable pursuit, but as a basic human right.
Wow.
That is incredible. So, you know, so that shift is really, in a way, what put Partners in Health on the map. One, just the fact that we had advocated for real treatment, both for drug-resistant TB and HIV. But two, that our solutions was to work with governments and to make things available in the public sector, not as a separate entity. And once you say, okay, we're going to treat HIV or we're going to treat drug-resistant TB, you need a lot of other stuff, right? You need to have labs. You need to have doctors and nurses. You need to have electronic medical records. So all of those things then can pull up a system. So rather than to say, this system doesn't have the absorptive capacity, we said, what does the system need to do the right thing? And that now is known widely as health system strengthening. That wasn't a term before that. So most interventions were pretty vertical, meaning one disease, one set of money. And what we and others tried to do was use vertical money to improve the health system. Julio Frank, former Minister of Health, Dean of the School of Public Health, Chancellor of the University of Miami, he's referred to that as the diagonal approach. Others refer to it as health system strengthening. We called it in media our battle horse. The battle was not against HIV. The battle was against the lack of healthcare. And so that we use this tool of HIV money to leverage against the battle. And so it was that work that really got us invited to many African countries, because many African ministers of health and presidents wanted to provide healthcare. They were happy that the HIV money was coming, but they didn't want to treat one disease. Even in countries where the prevalence is high, governments in Africa really, they wanted to use this money in this way. They didn't want more siloed projects. They didn't want more NGO-driven projects. And so that's why Partners in Health was then invited to expand to Rwanda, Lesotho, Malawi, and later, for the similar reason, because of Ebola, into Sierra Leone and Liberia. And interestingly, in the case of Ebola, when we said, yes, we'll help with Ebola, government said, please help us, but not just with Ebola. Help us make our health systems better. Help us prepare for the future by making sure we have doctors and nurses and water and sanitation and oxygen, electricity. Many of those things didn't have anything to do with Ebola. And they saw that we had done that in Rwanda and elsewhere. So we were invited to use this idea of diagonal or health system strengthening to improve the overall public provision of healthcare.
Wow. It's about an infrastructure. It's about funding. It's about how to disperse the funding. It's about working with the public sector and everything you described. Wow, what a lot of work.
Yeah, amazing team. We have just, we have 19,000 people on our team at Partners in Health. All of them, all but 100 are local professionals, doctors, nurses, community health workers, drivers who are working in the communities from which they hail and always working with public sector colleagues.
Well, really impressive. And even more impressive that you then have time for your educational roles as well, because of course, a big part of your role as well as working with Partners in Health is providing medical education at home and abroad. And you've just celebrated the graduation of the 8th cohort of the Master of Science in Global Health Delivery at the University of Global Health Equity in Rwanda, which is incredible. And, you know, as an initiative of Partners in Health, could you tell us a little bit more about the program?
Yeah. So Partners in Health, we have always considered ourselves an academic NGO in that many of our senior clinicians are faculty members at Harvard Medical School, and we've always taken an academic approach in terms of using the best available evidence, producing new knowledge, writing papers, articles, trying to influence with evidence. So we consider our, you know, our theory of change to be treating the sick and then training the next generation, training people to do those things, influencing with the evidence we can generate from the work, and then changing policy. So as you can see, that this training and evidence is a big part of our work, you know, and I feel like myself and so many clinicians around the world, to do this work every day and not to see the world changing would be incredibly frustrating. So we feel like we have to use our work as an example of what is possible, what can be done, train others to do it, write about it. So with the University of Global Health Equity, which we founded now 10 years ago in Rwanda, because the country of Rwanda has been able to have massive improvements in health, we thought, what better place to teach global health? The living example of Rwanda, from community health workers to, you know, long-term training programs. And the interesting thing about Rwanda is the health system is set up and designed specifically to achieve equity. So I was just hearing about the program in Singapore from one of my graduate students, have a tiered type of healthcare system, which we also do in the US, right? You can have good insurance, get everything. You can have concierge medicine, or you could have really no insurance at all and only be able to be seen if you come through the ER. But Rwanda has done absolutely the opposite, which is people are evaluated based on their means, and your insurance card depends on your category of economic well-being. And if you are in a lower category, you are fully subsidized. So the public provision of health is the same for everybody, but what you have to pay for insurance depends on how much means you have. So the richest people pay the most and the poorest people pay nothing. And so that institutionalizes equity in a way that many countries do not. I mean, we have glimmers of that in the fact in the US that we have Medicare, you know, Medicaid, but we don't have the same system. You know, and it is true, of course, in Rwanda, if you're very rich, you can go to a private clinic, but the public provision of care is done with equity in mind. So, you know, with that in mind and the advancements, we started the University of Global Health Equity, but specifically to teach about strategies for equity, because you're taught about the biomedical model of things. Like, this is a bacteria, this is a gene. But we know that actually disparities in healthcare and inequities are not driven by biology. They're driven by the social determinants of health, or I like to call them the social forces, because determinants are kind of fixed. But social forces have a vector, they have a magnitude, right? The force of racism on the US history created a bunch of inequities that then lead to health disparities. The lack of clean water and sanitation, which is a force, right? And the good thing about it being a force is we can push back, we can mitigate through policies. So the idea of the University of Global Health Equity is to provide very good education. We started with graduate programs in global health. We now have our medical students. The first cohort will graduate in 2025. But that fundamentally, their practice will be situated around the practice of social medicine, really understanding how the social, how the material, how the political impacts health. And that is also related to the program that I run at Harvard Medical School, the Master's of Science in Global Health Delivery, kind of the prototype for the one we have in Rwanda. And again, it's in the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine. So we're not saying what is cost effective. I mean, cost effectiveness is fine. We're not saying what is the most utilitarian. We're saying, what will it take to get to equity? That's a different question. So saying equity is the goal, and then how do you resource it? How do you design something? And so our students, both in Rwanda and Harvard, do not only the standard sort of public health research and epidemiology and biostatistics, but they also do qualitative research, talking to people to understand their lived experience of what will it take to get you to healthcare. If you don't have the means for transportation, you can't get to healthcare. If you don't have a sick day, the opportunity cost may be too high for you to go to the clinic. So really situating our work in trying to listen to what people need as we design programs for equity. And so that's a lot of the work we're doing, is trying to really institutionalize that thinking to move people away from just the biomedical and scientific to include the biosocial.
That's very, very impressive. And I think something that a lot of academia could benefit from, yeah. You know, how you come out of university with the things you've learned, you've come out with a skill, but actually how to apply that within a social setting, how to be able to integrate, how to understand really the way the world works, that you have to learn on your own. That's really, really interesting. That's incredible. And also Rwanda, the healthcare system, that's not something I was aware of, and sounds quite similar to how it works here in Germany, I think.
Interesting. I don't know the German system, but it may have more equitable outcomes. It certainly has more than the US. And we have some of the deepest inequities in health. And one of the driving forces, I believe, in the terrible, terrible COVID epidemic impact on the US was the existing social inequities we have. We have a large unhoused population. We have a large population of undocumented workers. We have a large population of people without insurance. And of course, those people did far worse. We have deep racism that has structured our social arrangement. And, you know, Black and brown people died at 2 to 3 times higher rate of white people. You know, people in certain zip codes died at 2 to 3 times higher rate. In the migrant worker community that we work in Partners in Health in Florida, the death rate was 6-fold higher than the white community in the same county. So this is not about a disease. It's about the social arrangements and our response to the disease.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make sure to come back in 2 weeks for the conclusion of this interview And stay tuned for the next couple of episodes to enjoy our mini-series on leading women in healthcare. A big thank you to Dr. Mukherjee for this interview. I'm Dr. Tanner Schrank.
And I'm Sophie Neal.
And this has been Beyond the Textbook. The links in the description can give you a more in-depth understanding of these concepts. If you like this episode, please give us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. You can check out the AmBOSS platform for your medical studies and sign up for a free 5-day trial at amboss.com.